Welcome to episode 2 of Not a Number. I'm Carl Bowden.
And I'm Ryan Stewart.
Show notes will be available at loomstate.fm/NAN/2. You can send feedback to NAN@loomstate.fm. You can find me, Carl, on Twitter, @CarlBowden.
And me, Ryan, on Instagram, @Selvage_Slayer.
The social network for designers.
Thanks, Carl.
Updates to the network are available on Twitter, @LoomstateFM. So who are we? I introduced myself last week. I'm a developer at Mezzanine.
I also work at Mezzanine with Carl, but I'm a designer.
Right next to me.
Yeah. We're sitting a little bit closer than we normally do. It's cool.
Comfortably close. A quick recap. I really didn't explain last week what the podcast was about, or the name, or the network. So I've wanted to do podcasts for a long time, because I like talking to people and because I find it a lot easier to understand the emotion and the intent behind things people say rather than just reading words, and because I'm terrible at writing. And there was a lot of people around me that also jumped at the opportunity to contribute as well. Hence why we decided just to start up the Loomstate website. I was puzzling Ryan for names. Loomstate came up, and it may not be a final name, but it is a great name for now.
It'll do.
And Loomstate came from the original intention of the things we like to talk about, design, denim, and development, and not necessarily in that order. So Not a Number, this podcast is about, it's about the intersection of work, fashion, and being a human, about not being a number. We've got Chris, Ryan, and myself. And between us, we've agreed to take care of the responsibility of getting something out each week. It's not going to be every week. And it'd be great to also get other guests on the show as well. The other podcast I'm doing is also a Apple developer interview series. Because in the time that I've been doing Apple development, iOS development, it's been very isolating to start with. And I've learnt so much just by being able to talk to people. And there's only so much, again, so much feeling and sense of community you can get from talking to people on Twitter. Whereas going to a Cocoa Heads meetup, meeting people in real life, you learn that they're just like you and I.
And also just jumping in and doing it, right? Like actually deciding that you're going to do an app, even if it's like, what was it? Catstagram. Catstagram app that you made, right? Carl made an example app just for a...
The ReSwift demo.
Yeah. Yeah, for a conference and then a designer catch-up thing. And yeah, surely like doing something like that is, you know, you would learn more than... You can only read and talk to people as much as can. And then since you jump in and actually start doing it, like anything, you know, you're at school studying a subject or whatever. And then as soon as you start working, you say, oh, I learned so much more, you know, once you start the job.
Yeah. Hence why we've jumped into the podcast feet first.
Yep.
Cool.
We listened to some podcasts. We thought, let's do a podcast. That's about it.
To start with, we better say grace. Dear Lord, I am thankful for coffee. It gets me through the day. I'm also really enjoying the raw denim I've got on now. They were, can't even remember without turning around.
Edwins.
The Edwins.
Yeah. Didn't we, actually, maybe we should start... Carl and I have been...
Raw Denim 101.
Yeah, we've been into denim for a while, and it's easy to forget what... It's easy to forget that people don't actually think of denim as being something that you could be into. Mm. I remember, I specifically remember the first time I met someone that was a denim head, as they're called. And it's like, I was like, what? You're into denim? Like, how can you sort of be into that? Like, what... Don't you just put them on and that's, you know, it's what your jeans are made out of.
What sort of vegan are you?
Yeah. But yeah, and so that was when I was in Sydney, I met a guy, actually his name was Carl as well, Swedish guy. Met him through a friend and asked before, one of the first questions he asked me, he was like, well, what are those, you know, what jeans are you wearing? I'm like, what? What do you mean? He's like, is that Selvage? I'm like, what the hell's Selvage? Like, what are you talking about?
So how long ago was that?
Probably about maybe about probably only about like 6 or 7 years ago.
Cool.
Yeah. And that was when I probably bought my first pair of raw selvage. It wasn't selvage. It was raw, just a normal pair of, good pair of jeans. Pace, actually. Swedish. Maybe that's why, because Carl was Swedish and then I just bought Swedish jeans.
So what are you on today?
I've got a pair of Railcar. Loving it. So good. But it's a Railcar is an American denim company, but not all the denim they use is American and Japanese. Most of all the good stuff is American and Japanese, really. There's only like one good, or maybe actually only one American denim mill, selvage denim mill, Cone, that's actually producing selvage denim. Selvage denim is like the
more traditional way of manufacturing denim.
Yeah, it's the old. It's the old way that they used to make jeans. The looms that they produce the denim on is a small, slow. Like they call it slow denim as well. Yeah, it's a shorter piece of fabric as well. It's not as wide, so you can't make as much. It's not produced as fast. And generally, like once you kind of get, if you're going to make a product like that, then you may as well make it out of premium ingredients, right? And techniques and so there's all sorts of stuff that can happen along the way. Getting back to loom state just means
independent nation.
It doesn't need to be selvage denim. I guess it could just be
a loosely intertwined independent nation of traditional values.
Unwashed, uninterfered with.
Unsanforized.
Unsanforized, yep.
An initial impression I got is that is going to be one of the most expensive things in the world, buying a very niche piece of denim.
Yeah.
And it surprised me that, like the Edwins I've got on today, they're a sanforized raw denim. Mm. I got them on special just at shopping centre, and I think I got out of that under $80.
Yeah.
And I've coming up a year on those now, be almost a year. And you can spend a lot of money, but you can spend a lot of money on anything in fashion.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also a lot of great, good quality, readily available, affordable denim as well.
Yep. And there's like, it's like anything, like the more you sort of get into a niche or an interest, you know, the more you dive into that, the more, I don't know what you say, like pure you want it to be. It's like coffee as well, you know, like Carl and I drink a lot of coffee, and the more coffee we drink, the stronger you want it, the better, you know, the more you know about it, the more you learn about it,
stronger, but the more refined your taste gets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
It's like absolutely anything. Yeah. So this is sort of the whole kind of premise of this, I guess, we're talking about quite, I guess, relatively obscure interests being denim. And then also, design and development, like what's the kind of, where are we at with that, you know? Like you got guys that are just starting out in design and dev, and how is their headspace different to someone like you and I now and what we sort of consider to be?
So jump into today's topic.
That was a long intro.
Nice work.
We'll edit that.
Probably
won't.
Design, development and tooling. And not so much about tooling either, more about set up and how to be a good citizen when you're dealing with somebody of the opposite role.
Mm. Yep.
We've got lots of great designer developers. James Noland up at Headjam, he can do great front-end development and also the design at the same time as well. And he came from educated in design as well as also learning all of the front-end development too. Once we get to talk to him, it'd be interesting to see his thoughts as well on how he lays out things in Photoshop, for example, so that he can understand them when he's doing the development as well.
James works in Photoshop, does he? I actually don't know this, but that's another thing too, I guess. Like, you know, what's your like preferred tool? And
that's a good point. That was a very big assumption.
I know Headjam use
the Adobe Suite.
Yeah, they use InDesign for stuff. I know they use it for web, which is a bit different. InDesign being traditionally a publishing, print publishing application.
Okay, the thing I want to know, when I receive a file and I try and extract RGB values out of a print design that's all done in CMYK, what am I doing wrong? How come the RGB values I get out of it are not what the designer would want me to use?
Because they've done it in CMYK.
What's the right process? What should the designer be doing and what should the developer be doing? Like for me as a developer, I inspect a layer, I use the eyedropper tool, pull out a color, and just select the RGB tab in Photoshop, copy the value into the variables file. And it's easy enough to use that value consistently throughout the design, but I don't always get the right value to what the designer had intended.
I don't think that's your fault though. That's the designer not knowing, like maybe not understanding the scope of work to start with. Like there's probably been, say if it was like a website, an app is a bit different because you've
also got color spaces to deal with there as well.
Yeah, effects. But not as drastic a thing as CMYK and RGB. In difference of trying to get RGB values out of a CMYK document, some colors are going to be drastically different. But I think that sort of like falls on the designer really sort of understanding, what's the purpose of what they're doing, and like where you knew, you know, when you're sitting down, you're doing the branding for a new company, you know, they're going to need a CMYK and RGB version of their logo, right?
So why would they need a CMYK version? Why can't everything just be done in RGB?
Because you're sitting here laughing. Because like what we're looking at on screen is like the computer trying to represent print, right? So the computer trying to create pigment out of light, right? So it's not entirely accurate, and it's up to the whatever software, you know, it varies between software as well, like how that's kind of represented on screen. It depends on the screen you're using and everything. Like you can't design a CMYK document with anything without looking at and getting, I guess, specific in how you want these colors to look without something like a Pantone book or something like that, where you know you're actually just typing in the numbers and you know that color is going to look like this when it's printed, hopefully.
Do color corrected monitors help in that regard?
It helps. Yeah, it definitely helps, but for how long, you know, it's something you need to keep up. But it's, even that, like it's almost like I think I accepted a long time ago that you're fighting a losing battle in trying to keep control over how something prints out without testing it like 100 times and print. You know, you can't do that. Obviously, you can't do that in commercially printed stuff.
When printing stuff, do you notice a lot of variation between the colours that actually get printed between different printers? What sort of affects that?
Yeah, definitely. I've never worked at a printer, so I don't know technically what the differences would be. Like I assume it's the actual press that they use would vary. And also, it's not even the press itself. Like I think, I'm sure there's like a million settings they have on something like that where they can, you know, bump up the black a bit. Dull down the yellow or whatever, if they know that it's a bit heavy or something like that. Like those machines are calibrated as well. That's another thing. Like you can have your screen can be calibrated and be perfect, but you know, send something off to the printers and their machine's not calibrated perfectly, or their eye is different to yours.
I notice the same thing in development as well. It doesn't matter how precise I am with RGB values. How it displays all depends on the monitor or device of the person that's using the website or device.
And even things like right now with the whole like GPU processing, that type of thing where it, like it super saturates colors. Have you seen that? Like in like the new like
in Illustrator.
Yeah, and all the like CC Adobe stuff is like just because I guess that's relatively new. Yeah, the GPU processing and the colors are different. If you switch between like GPU and CPU processing, you see the colors change. It's like what? What chance? We've got no chance. The internet does what it wants.
And because you also, once something goes into a development phase, you still have control over it up until the point where the person types in the address, loads up the website on their device. And at that point, you have no idea whether they're going to be able to see the difference between F9, F9, F9 and FFF.
Mm.
I have the contrast and brightness turned quite way down on my monitor, mainly because I stare at it for so long. And also because when designers come and look at a design on my monitor, they suddenly get a WTF moment, as in, where have all of those hairlines gone that I put into this design?
Yeah.
Why doesn't the content have the same... Why doesn't the content have a different background colour to the actual background of the document?
Mm. Designers are always going to get that as well. Like, not even with web stuff, anything digital. Like, any designer working for even a short amount of time will definitely experience this when you're probably designing on a nice, shiny new...
27-inch 4K iMac.
Yep, that kind of thing. The screen is like beautiful and is like designed to make everything look amazing with a huge color gamut. But then you've got, like the people that are receiving these files. Like, you know, if you create a document and looks awesome and you use like a couple of like really sort of soft grays and things like that, send it off to some suit that needs to approve it. And then they're like, email back and say, I can't see all this stuff. You know, why is this so light? I can't, you know, make it punchy, make it bold. You'll hear that forever. Anyone starting out in design specifically, get used to it. Get used to that.
Mm.
And I still complain about it. So all these years later, you know, and it's only because they're looking at it on some crappy screen running like Windows 95 and it's, you know,
or they're looking at it on a piece of nice high gloss 80 GSM paper.
Yep.
Because they refuse to look at anything on a computer and their secretary has to print everything out to them and give it to them at the beginning of the day.
I can't print a JPEG. Send me a PDF. I can print a PDF.
These animated GIFs look awfully funny.
This animated GIF isn't even moving once I print it out. Yep.
Printers.
Right.
Never understand those things. Okay, rant time. What's the feedback you hate getting back? The most frustrating sort of... You mentioned one.
You mean from a client or from a developer?
Start with clients.
Okay.
Don't bash me yet.
Okay. Feedback from a client.
It looks blurry. Make it bolder.
Punchy. Yeah. Punch, yeah. Anything, make it brighter, make it bolder.
Make it stand out.
We're speaking like straight to, you know, design students really that are sort of, you know, haven't started working yet. As I'm sure that any other designer that's had, you know, that's been in the job for a couple of months is already kind of experienced this sort of thing. But no matter, like, it's rare to get a client that understands design and doesn't think that they can design it themselves. That's probably the most infuriating part about my job is actually making, feeling like, you know, someone's paying you to do a job, let me do my job, not pay me to do my job and then you hold my hand through the whole thing. You know, learning how to use Photoshop doesn't mean that you're a designer. That's not what you're paying for. You're not paying for someone to control Photoshop. You're paying for someone that has X amount of years of design experience and understands how to communicate an idea efficiently. That's what you're paying for. And yeah, there's, it's just, you're always going to get that feedback of like, just make this bigger, make this bolder, make this, you know, and the client trying to design something. And I think, I mean, we're going to have podcasts about this, I think, for a long time, talking about how to communicate with a client effectively and keep control, right? Like,
they're not just paying you for your design skills, and a lot of them go into it thinking that, but that would be very naive to think that.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying you to solve a problem for them,
mm-hmm.
and they're coming to you because you're the expert that they want to solve it for them. I've worked for bosses that have a philosophy where they employ people because they're experts in their field and they want people who are experts to do what they do best. And then those bosses try and step in and take control as well.
Mm.
And that always causes conflict. And
it's not intentional, though, is it? Like, it's not. I think it's just this is part of the like the control thing and yeah. dealing with a client properly in a more efficient way is making people feel like they're involved.
I've noticed when bosses do it, a lot of it is often out of frustration. Why hasn't this person solved this problem? Why haven't they tried it this way? I've seen somebody else do it this way. Why don't you try and do it this way?
Mm.
And
they're only seeing the tip of the iceberg too, I guess, aren't they?
Yeah. But I suppose what can we do to remove that frustration? If that's frustration that causes them to step in, if we can remove that frustration, will that solve the problem? Will that let us do our job and deliver something to the clients that they're happy with? I mean, you could remove the frustration by not giving them any opportunity to be frustrated, by just delivering them a final product and sending them a bill. But that also wouldn't be very good for your reputation and ongoing work.
Mm. Unless you knew you nailed it. But, you know, there's still going to be some sort of communication there. You still need to, no matter what you're handing over, whether it's design or whether it's dev, you know, like you still need to justify. You still need to be able to back up everything you've done. I mean, I don't mean data-wise. in the dev world, you do need to back up your work. But in terms of like, you know, why have you done this? If someone's to ask you, you know, why have you done this? You need to have an answer for it. They're not necessarily asking you, why is this dot blue?
Yeah.
They're not saying change the color of this dot. They're saying, you know, why is it blue? You need to not say, oh, we can change it. We can, yeah. What color do you want it to be? You just need to actually have an answer of why that color, why that dot is blue, you know? Little things like that, like dealing with a client. It's just, and I don't think it's something that you're born with. You know, you come out of studying and you're, you know, you're a junior on the job. You learn all these things. You learn the frustrations. I think you need to experience the frustrations of these sort of client communications and understand how you can, work it better.
And how you can deal with the inculcated defensiveness you get when somebody asks you a question as well.
Yep.
So
it's confidence, right?
Yeah. Like, part of it's confidence, but also feeling protective of your work and defensive. So when somebody says, can you just make that heading blue for me?
Mm.
And it might be a really nice subtle green heading. The question they're asking isn't necessarily, why haven't you made it blue yet? It's more, can you explain the reasoning behind why you've made it green? They're not necessarily having a go at you.
Yep.
Sometimes they just don't understand why something has happened because they can't see your thought processes behind these things.
Yep.
And it's very easy to take those things as, oh, you've done a bad job because you've made it green and I wanted it blue. Why couldn't you read my mind?
Yeah. You probably tried it blue. You probably, like, you've worked your way. Like, the client is starting from the start and they're going through a similar thought process that you have. You're going to go through it much faster because you know things from experience, things that do and don't work, and you know the thoughts cross your mind of like, can this be blue? No, it can't be blue. Whereas, you know, a client might be like, let's make this blue, try it out, print it out. Oh yeah, is it working? Oh, let's ask a few more people. No, it's not really working. I don't really understand why it's not working. It just doesn't feel right. Yeah. Those sort of things, you know. This is what we're sort of getting to the root of, like, what you're paying for when you're getting a designer or a developer involved in a job. That you're paying for experience, you're paying for knowledge, you're not paying for a Mac operator, you know?
Yeah. So tensions between designers and developers then, are they just things out of frustration and defensiveness, or is it often a lack of skills and knowledge or lack of communication?
When you say tensions between designers and developers, what do you mean? How do you mean? I don't feel that with you, Carl. I don't feel tensions.
That's just because I'm so nice.
All right.
Okay, so things I get frustrated with designers.
Mm-hmm. You're looking at me.
I am.
I'm the only one in the room.
Anything that I have to ask questions about. And The problem is a lot of the designers that I've worked with have had many years' experience at web design, so they understand the type of things they need to design and the intent that they need to be able to portray in those designs mm-hmm. to give a developer enough information to be able to produce what that designer is intending.
Yep.
The frustrations I get are where the designs I receive aren't in a way that's easy for me to translate into a development process.
So do you mean if you can't easily find the hover state of, say, like, what does a link look like? It's hidden in the design somewhere. Is that what you mean? Like, if you need to hunt down that, that's time, those sort of frustrations, is that what you mean?
Both in that, and also I get very frustrated at the tools that designers use.
Oh, yeah.
Having to learn how to use Photoshop, Illustrator, InDesign, Sketch, InVision, anything like that that makes it harder for me to extract the information I need out of the design is going to cause me frustration in the development process.
Yep.
And I know that it's not the designer's fault, but oftentimes they're the closest person and the only person I'm talking to, and they're the ones that I have to take the frustration out on.
Yep.
And why can't you just learn HTML and CSS and do it yourself? It's not that hard. It's just numbers and letters.
Yeah.
And curly brackets.
Do you think it's
and semicolons.
Do you think it's it partly comes down to communication early on? You know, if on both sides, so a designer and developer talking to each other, saying, like, "Okay, what state am I going to get these files in? What type of files are they?" Oh wait, don't give me a Photoshop file. Give me a Sketch file. I don't even have Photoshop installed. From a developer side of things.
And so they end up just exporting it as a PNG and sending that to you.
Yeah, 1x. Mm. Cool.
Part of it's knowledge, part of it's tools, and I think a large part of it is the perceived value that the community places on those tools. So just because a tool is very common doesn't mean it's going to be the right tool for the job for you.
What tool are you speaking about specifically?
Photoshop.
Okay.
I zoom into a Photoshop document, I can't see the detail inside, you know, between pixels to see more depth. And often it's very easy for a designer to give me a Photoshop file that has vectors and symbols in it that are placed between pixels.
Mm-hmm.
And when that happens, I suddenly hit a freeze point, not knowing where to put that actual pixel.
Yep.
Do I round it down? Do I round it up? Where's my bottle of scotch? It's those sort of things all run through my head.
Mm.
And if I haven't had enough coffee, that can be frustrating.
Yeah.
So is that a problem with the tools? Is that a problem with experience? I think it's partly both.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's, I think that from a designer's perspective, deciding on what tools you want to use, and then also communicating with on the dev, like, on what they're comfortable using as well, and working out, actually knowing what's possible. Like, I think it's so valuable to for a designer to try and build a website, not using something like Muse or you know, one of these sort of WYSIWYG sort of editor.
Or Wix.
Just straight out. Get download brackets or Sublime Text or whatever, and get a Bootstrapper foundation, which is cool. That's fine. Like, it's a starting point, and actually try and build a website. Realize where the pain points are in front end dev, and all the little tiny decisions that you've never thought about before. Where do they happen? That's going to change your ideas about what's the right tool for me to create a file and hand over to a developer. And even if that does end up being Photoshop, you're not gonna use all these crazy print effects, you know, effects that are designed to, like, export a flat layer, a flat file or whatever, with these effects that come out perfectly, which just aren't gonna work in web. You've always gotta be thinking about, like, the transparency of a file being responsive these days. Like, everything needs to move, right? And so everything needs to be layered and fluid.
Mm.
How are these, like, effects going to work? How's like this weird, you know, crazy layer style that you've put on this
the masking, graphic, inverting, blurring gradient that you've applied to it.
How's that going to, how is that going to go when all of a sudden it's not perfectly positioned over this element that you've designed it to be? Little things like that, which you just don't understand unless you start to try and build a website. I think there's probably like a lot of, you know, in through uni and stuff now where part of your course is to build a website. And you do get a bit of an understanding of it, but I think that's all well and good. But coming out and if you were to freelance straight out of, you know, a lot of people, once they finish studying, might not have a job immediately. A lot of people that would be for. And, you know, that's the point where a lot of people, most, you know, would just quit and look at doing another course or something like that. The ones that want to stick with it, don't have a job immediately, are forced into freelance, you need to, you can't afford to spend all this time stuffing around with these programs. You need to know, you need to learn really quickly what you can and can't do in web and how that's going to affect your designs, how that's going to affect the files that you hand over to a dev. There's been heaps of times there when I had to do, you know, entire websites by myself from design to front-end dev and you know, pushing a site live and everything like that before all these sort of Muse-style applications are around, even though I still wouldn't use something like that today. I wouldn't feel comfortable saying to someone, I build websites, but I know enough about it to know what I should and shouldn't be doing in my designs. We've been talking more about the design side of things, I guess, but I don't know, Carl, like, is there on a dev, in the dev world, what's like, do you think there's value in, and this is it, like, this isn't I'm not asking a question that I already know the answer to. I actually would like to know, like, if there is value, in your opinion, in a dev knowing more about design.
One of the really nice intersections between the industries is things like Bootstrap and Foundation.
Mm-hmm.
The front-end toolkits where it feels like it's... when I see a designer who's used something like Foundation and Bootstrap, it's helped them understand all of the different states and components that need to go into and be thought about when building a website.
Because you're forced to... You need to design them.
Yeah.
And you know that your website isn't working right if you haven't actually declared what the state of something is meant to be. Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And when I receive a design that has just been done in Bootstrap and then, you know, border styles and things overridden, it at least shows that person has thought about how a client is going to be using and how an end user is going to be using the website as well.
Mm-hmm.
That it's not just something art-directed, but it's something more compositional.
Mm.
So it's taking different components from that framework and putting them together in a way that will make a usable experience for the end person. And I think that's where the tools lack a lot of value as well.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the tools, they are written by designers and by developers, for designers and for developers. But they don't keep up with the intersection between designers and developers. They're not, I mean, Sketch, for example. Sketch is one of the best tools I have at the moment. It is great for being able to design really effective layouts, apps, websites, and it has a myriad of plugins that are great for communicating animation, for communicating content design, such as the Envision plugin, Craft.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have, it's not built around communicating components and having a pre-built set of components that can help people understand all of the different things that need to go into building a website or building an app.
Mm.
It's built around tools, very primitive tools. And that's not a bad focus for the app. it gives you a lot of power and a lot of control over the creativity, but it doesn't give you a good set of guidelines on coming up with a design that is going to be usable and effective. And I understand that that is not an easy thing to do. And I know that there's been a lot of tools that have tried to cover it. You've got things such as, you know, fairly raw bootstrap editors such as Pinegrow. And it goes all the way up to things like, you know, Macaw, where it's a responsive, responsive website builder tool.
Prototype.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So things like Macaw are good for prototyping. Things like Pinegrow are okay for developing around frameworks. But none of them really cover the intersection of the things that websites need when it comes to understanding how a client or an end user uses that website. It's frustrating when also those components in those frameworks lend themselves to such bad design patterns as well. And by that, I mean things where a designer will throw in a hamburger menu to accommodate for pages and pages of navigation just because that's the default element that's available in the design file.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't solve the problem of looking at how content is structured.
Yep.
It solves the problem of how to hide it in a way that a developer can understand how to build it.
I think that is also a part of, I guess, inexperience in a designer, not understanding information architecture and UX thoroughly enough, where just because it shouldn't appear on this main page, it's just hidden in a menu and hamburger, cool, without any thought into whether this page should actually even be on the website or should I even be using a hamburger, more importantly.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hamburgers are interesting because they tend to hide a myriad of sins.
Yep.
They have a reasonably strong understandability stronghold across...
within an industry.
Yeah. So many people still have absolutely zero idea what to call that icon.
Yep.
Like just talking to people in the office.
We're talking about those three little horizontal lines that you might see on mobile websites and apps.
Yep.
Top left hand, top right hand corner, whatever.
The icon.
Bottom left, middle of the screen, wherever the designer decides it needs to be.
The top right that pops out from the left.
Yeah, makes sense.
The websites that have them on the both left and right.
Oh, where's it coming from?
They have it in the middle and at the bottom. That they produce different elements on the screen for the same navigation.
Top right, slides up from the bottom.
Wix.
Awesome.
I've heard people call them the menu button, the options button, the more button.
The options button.
Options. They'll see apps that have options hidden inside that hamburger menu.
It's just laziness. It's laziness.
And then you see different styles of the icon. Two lines, three lines, kebabs.
Mystery meat
navigation. I tend to lean towards the word menu simply because that is very explicit in what you're going to be getting when you tap that button.
It's confusing when you go to a restaurant website, though.
Especially if you're a vegetarian.
So and they're just empty kebab sticks. Mystery with
fake
some veggies on it. Yep.
Fake and burgers.
I used to be vegetarian, Carl.
I know.
I still went to those websites. I still knew what that meant.
You make meat clubs so hard to deal with. And it's not there's nothing explicitly wrong about using a hamburger menu. I absolutely abhor it, though, when it is the default option for hiding navigation and complexity.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with it being a good solution. It is completely invalid, though, when it's something that's just a default option to hide the lack of thought put into it.
It should just be like could we create an icon for a rug? You know, anything, you just want to sweep it under the rug. Sweep it under that menu. That's what it is. That's exactly what it is.
It is.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, drink to that.
Cool.
So then what are the other good options we have? iOS, we've got the tab bar down the bottom of the screen. In Android, they still tend to have a menu icon in the top left. And what happens if you don't have enough space on a tab bar at the bottom of an iOS app to hide all of the items?
Okay, so that's a design problem.
That's
okay.
A very leading question.
Yeah, so it's a problem with your content.
Correct.
Yeah. So instead of, you know, you might get an inexperienced designer coming into something like that and just trying to fit everything on the page, everything within the website, app, whatever, without any consideration into, yeah, should this even be here? You're only making the entire app or website more complicated and unnecessarily. Have you got some examples, Carl?
For the record, I am about to show Ryan an example of somebody who's tried to reinvent the hamburger structure. So I'll throw a link to the website in the show notes, but basically it's instead of putting a hamburger at the very top of the screen, when you tap on the tab bar down the bottom, an icon in the tab bar, it will slide up the screen to reveal more options.
Yeah, so it's an iOS style tab bar.
Yep.
That moves up when you select an item to reveal. So basically a drop down or drop up version of a iOS style tab bar. Yeah.
Hmm.
It's pretty cool. The coolest thing is the hamburger in the top left hand corner of the website that's showing this example. It's just little lines just floating around. It's really cool. And it just brings your attention to, like, you know what? You don't need this thing. Here's a solution. I don't know your thoughts on this, Carl, but I reckon, oh, and actually when they're like showing examples of it once it's open and flicking through. So normally when you have if you had a navigation, normal navigation on a website and you have a click on an item and a drop down appears, and then you have to like click on another, say the option that you're looking for isn't in that list and you need to click on a different item to see that drop down menu. What happens? What's the interaction there? Like, does the old one slide up? Does it just disappear? Does the new one not appear until the other one's, you know, disappeared? Do you have to click on it again to force it to open? All little like things like this that need to be considered are all part of the UX that you might not immediately realize. So, and this one actually has a really cool solution to that.
I'm going to have to come back to that sentence, but the alternative that I would have immediately jumped to for this situation is to have a pop-up associated with each of those items so that with an associated indicator on the item to show that it would have a pop-up. It's not immediately obvious. People naturally associate those tab bars at the bottom just to be able to jump to a screen.
Go to a screen, yep.
And the items that they're displaying under those each of those tabs, you'd probably call a filter item or a submenu item.
Mm-hmm.
So for something like a newsfeed, you could tap on it and you could see items sorted by latest or items sorted by most popular. That would be something that would be best placed at the top of the screen, because you would be filtering the content of that screen from the top down.
Mm.
That's naturally how you read things. So I'd be surprised if somebody would expect to find a filter at the bottom of the screen when it's filtering the content and people naturally read from the top down.
Yeah, it flows down.
Yeah. Whereas, so the settings screen, the profile screen.
But see, UX is like just learning about like what's stupid, right? Like you're learning about like what the stuff that you don't think about and recognizing it and applying it to a design, right? Because you'd get people that would put a filter down the bottom just because it's like, oh, it looks cool down here. Or you get to the bottom of the page and then you go, oh, that's actually not what I was looking for. I'll change the filter there. And like there's all sorts of reasons why people would justify putting a filter down there without understanding that, no, this is actually where good UX puts a filter at the top, because that's where you know, it's the stupid place to put it. And I don't mean stupid as in like, it's stupid putting it there. It's stupid because you're appealing to stupid people.
It's stupid once you understand the alternatives and how they can make the experience better.
Yep.
It almost feels like UX is the psych degree of the design and development world.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's not a knock on UX, though. So much of it comes down to understanding how people think, how they react, how they interpret things, and how they're going to use a design once it's in, once they see it applied to them in front of them, how they interact with things.
Mm. And also, that's a good point. Like, UX isn't, being like an expert at UX doesn't mean that you know the answers. It means that you have a bit more of an idea of how someone might interact with something. Right? Good UX gets tested and tested and tested and tested. Like, it's
fail early, fail often.
Yeah, that's right. Like Carl and I have been building an app for about two years now, and it's something that we're, you know, doing on like weekends and holidays and after hours, that type of thing. And because we've been building it for so long, focusing mostly on iOS, really, iOS has changed so much in that time as well. So we've had to, scrap the app two or three times, start over again. And I feel like we're actually at a good spot right now where we're getting things out quickly. And
yes, we've tried hamburger menu.
We've tried that. We've scrapped it. Yep, we've done lots of things.
It's just a matter of experience.
Yeah, one thing that I tried like three, four weeks ago and finally realized that the world is not ready for text that doesn't look like a physical button. The world is not ready for that. Okay, so, showing someone a login screen, like literally launching the app, showing them the screen, and the only thing on the screen is a logo and sign in, create account. And they're just words, right? It's not a button. It is a button, but it doesn't look like a button. It's not in a square. It doesn't have a shadow under it. Doesn't look like you can press it down. It's just the words, right? I was trying to see if people are ready to click on words. They're not. I think I showed it to four people. Three people said, "What do I do?" And these are people that use phones. These are people that use phones all day, every day. And it's like, I often like think about like, what if, someone from the future that's like, 10 years ahead of us comes back and says like, "I have the answer to all your UX problems." They're not going to be relevant for another 10 years. It's like where people are at that stage, that's where UX is at. It's like we're always appealing. UX is as advanced as the lowest common denominator,
So the takeaway, folks, is that the world is not ready to get rid of skeuomorphism. Buttons still need to look like buttons.
The world is not ready for words. There you go. Is that the title of this show? I think so.
Probably. World's not ready for buttons. Words. World's not ready for words.
Yep.
And, that must be so frustrating as a designer to come up with something that looks great and looks usable, and then as soon as you stick it in front of somebody, what do I do with it?
Yep.
And it's exactly the same in the development world as well, but not just with developing something that you then push back to a designer and they don't know how to use, but also something where you're writing code that has to go to other developers as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you write code that other developers don't know how to maintain, that is just as much, that's just as disastrous to a project as something that users don't know how to use either. Because it means that, 6 months' time, when you've forgotten everything about the project and you have to come back and do maintenance on it, you're in just the same boat as any other developer would be.
Mm.
You need to be able to understand your code. And a lot of it's down to communication. How do you communicate what all the different states for this button should be? Yeah, it comes down to things about being explicit about intent. James had a good illustration the other day of a pseudo after element that has content and text transform uppercase.
Mm-hmm.
Should I just make the actual text in this item uppercase, do I really need the text transform uppercase attribute on this item as well?
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you leave text transform uppercase on there, it's going to tell every other person that comes back and looks at that code that the intent yep. is to make this uppercase.
Yep.
And so then it doesn't matter if they make it lowercase in the content, it's still going to be made uppercase as well.
It's almost like a browser default, like in that you've if you're declaring what something should look like, other developers know that you actually want it to look like this. You're not letting the browser decide.
Yeah. Yeah, it's...
So if they can see that you've actually said text transform uppercase, that's what it's meant to be. That's what it's always going to be.
Yeah, it's about being not just making it look good, but also being able to communicate how something should be in the future and why you've done it.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is missed in just making something... just typing the words in an uppercase, or just sticking something in an all plain text and then adding in paragraphs at development time, at view time, when the actual intent is to have something that can also be used as plain text in an email or something as well.
Mm.
About displaying the intent to the person who's using that code or entering that content, and to be able to communicate effectively with them that it's not just about what they type in, it's about how the person that is going to be viewing it is intending to be able to see it.
Mm. Do you think that's also getting back to designers handing over files that are more thorough, more easier for a developer to understand, and to understand not just... like visually how a design looks on the page, but like what the designer plans going forward if they design something right. So example being the text transform thing, right?
Yeah.
You could easily just type in, you know, this heading and hold down shift, caps lock, whatever.
Yep.
But if you were to type it in lowercase and then in the attributes, say if you're using something like Sketch, hit the actual like text transform button that transforms any text of that style into uppercase. Seeing something like that, surely that says to you as a developer, oh, they've made a point of like actually making this style uppercase.
That goes a long way.
Yeah.
Whenever I see that, I do explicitly make the attribute text transform uppercase.
Yeah. And that's just like a little tiny decision that you'd make instead of actually typing it in uppercase into the HTML.
Yeah.
I'll actually put that attribute.
It helps a lot also for translation as well. If you need to translate that into another language,
okay.
It explicitly ties the intent of the content. Not every language is going to be translated effectively into uppercase characters,
mm-hmm.
but it implies the intent that this is more important.
Right.
And that in that language, you can then accommodate for it.
Yeah.
In that language, you might make something bold instead,
mm-hmm.
or you might use a different word. But the intent is that this has more importance because you're making it uppercase.
Yeah. So that's the difference between looking at something, a designer thinking about something visually, and a developer thinking about something going forward, actually, what is the use of this? How is this website going to be used? What are the possibilities here? A designer understanding, don't need to understand the whole thing, right? Every sort of use case of how developers... going to make something, right? But just understanding that's actually a split second decision that you make, not to hold down shift, but to press that uppercase button instead, solves so many answers so many questions for a developer that, you know, that they don't even have to think about. You know, it's just.
Mm. So do you think by default that all computers should have caps lock disabled?
I'm going to say yes.
I actually love having my caps lock mapped to, what is it? Command, Option, Control, Shift.
Is that shutdown?
no, that is what I call the super meta option key.
What is it? Command?
Command, Option, Control, Shift. When I hold down caps lock, it's exactly the same as holding out all four of those keys.
Right. I thought you meant if I hold down caps lock, as in like, this button should not be used I'm just going to have this map to shut down.
It doesn't do caps anything.
All right.
So I can hit caps T to open up a terminal or caps C to open up Chrome. Mm-hmm. And it's just easier. It's just a shortcut rather than having to hold down all four of those buttons because they're not commonly used in other applications. Mm-hmm. You don't commonly see a shift control option command V. So in the development side then, if I was to give you a, let's go as the example, a WordPress theme, and I was to give you all of the code and for you to set that up on your machine to give you an example of something local, like a staging environment that you can look at the design and how it would be portrayed to the end user. Mm-hmm. So what do you call that? You'd be seeing the in progress, the staging design of the code.
Mm-hmm.
I know that I've tried to present different pieces of code to you in the past, different code bases. I have not found anything that has stuck effectively to a designer that's easy enough for them to portray their ideas into.
So do you mean I'll give you a design, you code it up, you send me a link to a staging site where I can edit the CSS to tweak the design? Is that what we're talking about?
Yeah. If I set up a local staging environment on your machine,
yep,
that you can edit and that you can tweak the design and then commit it and push it back to the repo.
Yep.
It's been very difficult to get a designer to be able to find that workflow usable.
Yeah, I think it's, when you say it like this, when you say you describe it like that, it doesn't sound that that involved or technical.
No.
But it's like me coming up with a brand new design tool. Finding some new tool on the internet and creating a whole new website or an app, whatever, inside of this design tool and then handing over that file and then you having to sort of like learn this application to figure out how to extract the CSS that you need or whatever. I think it's probably a similar thing. If you're like before when you were sort of talking about getting all these different types of file formats and then you having to like, oh, I don't even use Illustrator. How, like, now I need to like extract all this information from it. It's probably a similar type of thing. It's because you think designers and developers think about things differently.
Mm. As you were saying it, I was then thinking this sounds exactly like the reverse of what I was complaining about with the tools.
Yeah. It's not
here's a code base, just open up terminal, cd into the directory, run gulp,
yeah.
Fire up a web browser, go to this address and then open up your code editor, point it at the folder. As you edit the SCSS files, the browser will live reload. Simple.
Yeah. I like, we have experimented with this a little bit and I have done it a little bit, but it's just a bit, it's almost like, oh, like, I think it gets to a point where it's probably taking me too long to do that and you're probably just getting, like, frustrated and go, I'll just do it, whatever, like that. That might be happening as well.
It's not just frustrating for designers. It's also frustrating for new developers as well.
Right.
When they're trying to set up an environment, they've got so many tools to deal with. They've got to set up Grunt or Gulp.
Mm-hmm.
They've got to get NPM and package.json file up and running. They've got to work out what packages they need to install. They've got to work out why they're getting GitHub limiting errors. They've got to work out, I've also got to install Ruby and get the latest, install RVM, get the latest Ruby version so that I can run Compass, so that I can get Gulp working, so that I can get something live reloading in the browser. And it is such an intricate and it's such a personal thing mm-hmm. between every developer that you just sort of get to the point where you just start copying the setup from one project to the next and then tweaking each one along the way. There's no common setup and common environment that you use between all of the projects because it's just so frustrating to try and start from nothing and get to something that's usable.
Mm.
I can completely understand why any designer would be turned off from the idea of having to open the terminal at all. And I don't have any good solution for it either.
Mm.
We could come up with tools that are going to give them a GUI where they can just drag a folder in and hit play, but it's not going to solve the problem of the development environment and the tools changing rapidly. That's something that we're always going to face in the development environment. You're going to have to develop the GUI tools or any other supporting tools as rapidly as the environment changes.
Do you think that's like what these companies like Adobe and Macor? Who makes Macor?
Macor?
Is it? That's the product. I don't know if that's the company.
I can't remember. It's been a while since I used it, to be honest.
Mm. Like, people are aware of this issue. Are they, like, we're starting to see products that are trying to solve it almost at a point of, like, much earlier on as well, like this whole thing of, like, putting emphasis on prototypes and being able to extract developer-ready code, supposedly. Like, it seems like a kind of not up to that problem yet. They're trying to sort of solve some issues earlier on in the flow of a job, do you think?
Yeah, it's like they're trying to solve the problem of the development and the design environment rather than solving the problem of being able to portray the intent of what those people are trying to solve.
So trying to eliminate the point of where a site's built and the short time of backwards and forwards of tweaking?
Yeah, like...
trying to eliminate that time.
There's a tool for the foundation framework. You download it to your Mac, boot up the GUI tool, and it will create a project. It will install foundation and set up a live reload environment so that you can make changes to the CSS and see it live in the browser.
Mm-hmm.
It's very specific just to foundation, though. And you know, it's 150, 200 meg to download, plus then expanding on install. And that's not explicitly a problem with foundation, the size and the slowness of it. It's more of a problem with the actual development process. But again, it's only trying to solve the problem of the development environment being more friendly.
Mm.
And that is a problem, but it's not as much of a problem as being able to portray the intent of how you are trying to solve a problem.
Yep.
Like, your problem might be that nobody's clicking on the banner on a homepage of a website. That's a very different problem to, I don't know, the trying to change the color of the background or trying to make a drop shadow more visible so that you can see that something's a button. So it feels like the GUI tools for developers are built for people who don't understand development. And I don't think that's a problem that we can solve easily, because there's always going to be people who are new to the process who do want something to help themselves get up and running. And there's always going to be a space for those tools, but they're also not, they don't feel like they're the correct tool for everybody in the industry to be using. There's no right one way or one right tool that you can give everybody to solve the problem. It's solving very different problems to being able to communicate effective intent and effective development processes and effective user interaction. I don't think writing tools to make the development or design process easier is the right way to solve it. It's the more limited part is having tools that can communicate the intent more effectively.
Mm. But there also like comes a point where you can't just keep making these tools and expect one day for designers to be developers.
Yeah.
You know, there's still always going to be that point where it needs to cross over. So, you know, focusing on trying to eliminate those questions or make things more intentional in the design, not in a visual way, of how it's represented, but in a like in a metadata way, you know, like in a way that is not it's you can't see it outside of design, right? It's inside of the application that we're using.
So are you talking about something like AnimateMate that will give you keyframe animations on what happens when you hover a button or what sort of tweening this menu should use when it slides in?
Yeah, there's...
That sort of metadata? Meta information?
Not specifically, because I think that is actually represented visually. So something like AnimateMate, shows how fast the button pops back up again, say. I don't know. Or how fast something slides in once you hit this button, okay?
Yeah.
If there's easing on it, is there a shadow on it? How long does that take? That sort of stuff can be represented visually with tools like that. I'm more talking about stuff that happens inside of the application that's in like the properties of an object on the page, so that there's no almost like browser overrides.
Yeah.
You know, so they're being declared, and just because the text doesn't change in appearance at all, doesn't matter. It's that it's been declared that it should still look like this. You know, this font, this size, this line height, whatever. Even though that may actually be exactly the same as what the browser default is, or what the application. Well, I guess in that example, what the makeup of the font itself is.
So I may not be representing a heading that goes over two lines, but I'm still giving explicit information as to the line spacing if there are two lines.
Yep, exactly. That sums it up heaps better than what I was just saying. Whereas I would actually just make an example that has two lines. You don't necessarily need to do that if you've...
Are explicit about... The attributes on that text.
Yeah, so that's something that's invisible if you don't have the example of it, but it's there. And that comes back to like communication and like trust between like the developer knows that the designer has thought about that and has set this style up to be right. So communication, yep.
So I think a lot of this then comes down to what the actual differences are between design and development. Mm-hmm. A lot of it feels like it is communication with an end client, with an end person, with a user, communicating intent and content. And a lot of the design and development fields do overlap a fair bit. Designing as in designing the interaction, and then development as in changing the values of how long that interaction takes, how long the animation takes to display that interaction.
Mm-hmm.
Those sort of things feel like they could very easily be solved by providing a tool for somebody developing that interaction to be able to do both the design and the development at the same time. That doesn't necessarily need to be a developer that goes into an interaction file and copies the value out and pastes it into the CSS file.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're going to have to leave that for a topic next time, though.
Yeah.
So where does design end and development begin?
Something around like what Edge Animate used to be, I guess.
Yeah.
Yep.
Used to be. That's your homework.
Okay.
Anyway, nice talking to you tonight, Ryan.
Mm-hmm. Nice talking to you, Carl.
And again, show notes available at loomstate.fm/NAN/2. And that's it for today.
See ya.
Bye.